Welcome to the Swan Signal Podcast, a production of Swan Bitcoin, the best way to accumulate Bitcoin using automatic recurring buys at swanbitcoin.com. I'm Brady, head of education at Swan. Swan Signal pairs up great Bitcoiners for compelling discussions that I think are very unique on the Bitcoin content scene. Every week, we broadcast Swan Signal live on Twitter at Swan Bitcoin and on YouTube at youtube.com/swansignal. Then we publish the audio here. This week, I am joined by Gigi, author of 21 Lessons, Udi Wertheimer, independent software developer and host of the Reckless VR Meetups, as well as Swan founder Corey Clipston. I'm glad you found your way here. Hope you enjoy. Hello and welcome back to Swan Signal Live. We're at episode 16 here. Swan Signal is a production of Swan Bitcoin at swanbitcoin.com. It's the easiest way to accumulate Bitcoin with automatic recurring buys. You just connect your bank account, auto-fund that USD. We automatically stack your sats, and you can set up automatic withdrawals. We want you to hold your keys, as is Bitcoin best practice. We do all of this at the lowest fees in the industry in the United States, up to 80% lower than Coinbase, up to 57% lower than Cash App for automatic recurring purchases. You can follow us on Twitter. If you're not watching on Twitter, we're at Swan Bitcoin on Twitter. We are at youtube.com/swansignal if you want to flip over there to watch, if you prefer the YouTube. And I just wanted to give a quick show also for SwanForce, our referral program. It's at swanforce.com/enlist. You can refer Bitcoiners. You can earn money, earn sats, actually even better, for recruiting new Bitcoiners. So check that program out. You'll get the details there. 0.25% on every recurring purchase, every Swan plan purchase that your referrals make for 3 years. It's a massive deal. Check it out. All right, let's get to the show. I want to welcome back to Swan Signal, Gigi, the author of 21 Lessons, What I've Learned from Falling Down the Bitcoin Rabbit Hole. Welcome back, Gigi.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
Absolutely, man. And Udi Wertheimer, an independent software developer and host of Reckless VR Meetups. Welcome, Udi. How's it going?
It's great. Thanks for having me. Hey.
Glad to have you, man. And Corey Clipston, founder of Swan Bitcoin. Corey, how are you today?
I'm doing well. It's good to be here with you guys. Good to see your avatar again, Gigi and Udi. Really excited to have a chat here.
Good to see your sunglasses again, Udi.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. I hope everyone recognizes me this way, hopefully.
All right, so let's kick it off talking about, you know, one of Bitcoiners' favorite approaches to understanding Bitcoin. In fact, I think it's just in general, humans like to approach understanding complicated, complex topics and, you know, new technology by applying analogies to them, right? We have no shortage of analogies in Bitcoin. So I'd like to know, let's start with Gigi, what is your current favorite Bitcoin analogy as you try to understand, continue to understand what's going on here?
Yeah, that's a great and a big question already. I think my personal favorite is still contrasting it to biology itself. And I really like Brandon Quinnham's thinking on that, who says it's analogous to mycelium, to a mushroom network. And it's obviously a networked thing. So comparing it to a networked organism, I think is it makes sense in a lot of ways. And I still love what Ralph Merkel had to say about Bitcoin very early on, that it's the first example of a new form of life, like a thing that lives in cyberspace, pretty much. But as you said, you know, like there are so many ways to think about Bitcoin and so many analogies and ways to describe it. Yeah, I actually still think about it a lot, and I'm currently trying to collect my thoughts on that because I think it's obvious that Bitcoin is different things for different people. And I also like the description that Plan B gave, that we can definitely describe different phases that Bitcoin went through, and we are about to head into a new phase, at least if his model holds up and if Bitcoin continues to rise and rise, so to speak. And what this phase five will be kind of interesting. And I think our understanding of Bitcoin will evolve alongside with it. But I think it will always be helpful to think of it as its own entity in a way, like its own living thing, and it kind of exploits us to keep it alive, and it pays people to keep it alive, and it will, whatever you throw at it, it will try to overcome it as life does, you know? Life finds a way, as they say.
Absolutely. Udi, how do you approach Bitcoin in terms of analogizing it? What do you like to compare it to?
Well, I love Gigi's example. It's awesome. I think that actually probably the first person or one of the first persons that introduced me to Bitcoin, I'm not going to say who it is, but they used to say that Bitcoin is digital real estate. And I actually really like that analogy because it's I think it's much easier for people to grasp than digital gold, just because a lot of people are not really interested in investing in gold. Like the most, you know, probably the most majority of people aren't interested in gold at all, except for maybe for jewelry. But real estate is someone that everyone understands, and it's pretty similar. You know, it's scarce. It's everyone wants it, so it's pretty good. It's a pretty good example. It's very limited. There's never going to be more. You're not even going to find more in the moon. That's it. That's what we have. And there also have been like similar kind of fights over getting the early Bitcoins and kind of land grabs on the early Bitcoin ecosystem that I think are very similar. So I like that analogy. Also, it's a better Ethereum. No, not really. Not really.
So, Gigi, I've heard you talk about comparisons to open source software, and I thought you might want to riff on that for a little bit.
Yeah, sure. I gave a talk on that actually. It had the name Competing with Free at the last Valley of Bitcoin conference. And I think what most people still don't really get about software in general and Bitcoin in particular is that Bitcoin is not a company. And it is important to really deeply understand that, because no matter how large the company, a company will go bankrupt. You know, a company doesn't have this feedback mechanism that Bitcoin has. Bitcoin can outlive pretty much anything, I think. And a company simply can't. Like if your funding dries up or if some catastrophe happens, then your company will simply go bankrupt and that's it. And it doesn't matter if you're Google or Facebook or Coca-Cola or whatever, in like 200 years, those companies probably won't exist anymore. And open protocols and open software, like open source software, free and open source software, it wins for a reason. I think that Linux and the free software stack that basically the internet is built upon, it won out for a reason. And it's because it's still there and people can always take it up and improve it and work with it. And the same is true for Bitcoin. It will always be there and people can use it as they see fit. And once you truly grasp the profundity of this, I think it's obvious that you're dealing with something else, you know, like it's not a new PayPal or anything like that. It's way, way, way bigger than that. And yes, it might take time to develop, as Linux also took its time to develop, but now it absolutely dominates the software market. And I think the same will be true for Bitcoin and the financial world.
All right, so let's get into VR. This is, both of you guys are known for being VR aficionados. We actually acquired at Swan several headsets, Oculus Quest headsets, to participate in some of this Bitcoin VR activity. I've been to one of Udi's meetups. So, you know, after decades of speculation, Bitcoin, you know, VR has been speculated about for a long time. It's finally available in a, you know, decent form, a very usable form to mainstream consumers. What would you like to see in the future in terms of Bitcoin? I'm sorry, I keep saying Bitcoin. In terms of VR technology, enhancements and development, Udi?
The interesting thing about Bitcoin and VR, both share this huge skepticism from the mainstream. So if you search for VR articles, you probably find VR is dead as the first result. And similarly, you'll find that Bitcoin is dead if you search for Bitcoin. So it's a nice, you know, it's a nice mix of interest there. And VR has been around for so long. I mean, it's been around for decades, really, but at least in the current generation, it's been around since 2012, 2012, I think, and in 2016, the first like consumer hardware came out. And these days, it's actually really simple. So something like the Oculus Quest by Facebook is really easy to set up, to power up, to use for the first time. We've had great, so we run the Reckless VR meetups, which are every Saturday, and we try to do like Bitcoin content, technical stuff and other Bitcoin stuff. And we bring speakers over every week. And a lot of times those speakers have never used VR before. We ship VR headsets to them and we walk them through setting it up and trying it out for the first time. And it actually works great. I mean, it's got to a stage where, you know, you can do that, which is amazing. If you look 10 years back, it was impossible. You know, you'd need a professional just to help you set it up. So it's really great. But also, you know, the platforms that we end up using and the platforms that are available for, you know, for social experience are so early and they're very buggy, they're very limited. They're not very well supported by hardware, so you can use them with some VR headsets, but not with others. And you definitely cannot use them on your mobile phone. You can't use them on your laptop probably, which is very limiting because most people don't have this equipment. So it's like, it's a great experience. It's for those who are there, it's amazing. It's really very similar to being with someone in the physical space, which is obviously something that we're all missing right now. So it's really great in that regard. But it's kind of difficult to get people to the point where they're you know, where they're there because the hardware just isn't very well adopted. So obviously I'd love to see the costs of those headsets go down. I'd love to see it, although it's not too bad right now, it's $400 for the Oculus Quest, which is, you know, similar to what you would pay for an Xbox or a PlayStation or whatever. So it's not a bad price point. But still, we'd love to see it go down. We'd love to see it, you know, smaller and more compact and less heavy and so on, more comfortable. And there's a lot of work on the software side. I mean, the hardware is almost there, kind of. But there's a ton of work on the software side, which is really difficult because the ecosystem is so small and the audience is so small. I mean, maybe 1 million or 2 million headsets are available worldwide. So because the audience is so small, it's really hard for companies to invest significant sums of money in building amazing software if there's no one to buy it or not a lot of people to buy it. So it's going to be a slow process. And that's why, you know, a lot of people are unhappy about Facebook being super involved in this, obviously because of privacy concerns and things like that. But there is an upside. I mean, a company like Facebook can afford to invest in this for a long period of time until it catches on, which is something that most companies just can't do. So it's good that we have a company like Facebook that does it. I hope that we'll see a few other large companies join that race, like maybe Apple, maybe Microsoft is kind of looking at it. So it would be good to not have just Facebook controlling this whole thing because that probably wouldn't end well.
Yeah, absolutely. Gigi, as a fan of VR, what would you like to see in terms of tech improvements, software improvements in the future?
Yeah, well, I think I want to see it more normalized in a way, the way that video calls are normalized, because I think there is still just this kind of weird icky feeling that people have that what you want to meet in VR and it's clunky and it's weird and it's different definitely. But what I think that people really underestimate is, as Udi mentioned, how real it feels, because you're really sharing, albeit a virtual space, but you're sharing a space, and the dynamics are very different than in a group Zoom call, for example, because you're actually in the room and the mechanics are that the closer you are to a person, the louder you will hear them, and people will just fade out. If you're too far away, you won't hear them anyway. So after a talk is over, for example, in this Bitcoin VR meetups, and especially at the after parties, small groups will form naturally and they will discuss different topics, and that's just impossible in like a 20, 30 person Zoom call. So it's really natural. So I think that's what people really underestimate. It's really like going to a conference, and you will be standing in one corner with the 3D printing gun nuts and discussing how 3D printing guns will liberate everyone. And in another corner, there might be some traders that got wrecked recently and discussing their strategies. And so that's just always very, very interesting to observe how this forms naturally. And I think that's very underappreciated how great this actually works.
Yeah. So I think some people, you know, have some skepticism about the, you know, utility or reason to use VR meetups as opposed to Zoom, for instance. What are the experiential differences for users, and why, you know, would I buy a headset to participate in AltSpace, for example? Do you want to take that one first?
Yes. So as Gigi said, one of the amazing things is that because conversations are positional in the virtual space, you can organize in very dynamically and very organically. You can organize in different groups inside the space and chat just like you would in real life, which is absolutely impossible in Zoom calls. So, you know, in Zoom calls, you would usually have two, maybe three people speaking, and then there would be like dozens of people watching. And it's just a very, very different experience. Mm-hmm. So it's very similar to the real world in that way. And also you kind of, so for example, for people like us, for Bitcoiners, there's a very special benefit there, because you can be present. People can see you, you know, move your hands. They can see what you're looking at, and they can look at your face. They can see your lips move, but they don't see who you are. They don't see your face. They only hear your voice, which some people even change their voice so that they're not recognized through their voice. And so you get to keep your privacy while also being present. So you definitely can't really do that with Zoom, but you also can't do that in real life. So that's the only place you can do that. It's kind of amazing. I think those two things, you get to meet people that you just otherwise wouldn't meet. It's very, very different from Zoom calls in that regard. And when you're thinking of, so the meetups are, the Reckless VR meetups, the major part of them is a presentation or a panel. And you could think, well, this seems similar to watching like a presentation on YouTube. And it is, it is similar, but there's the networking before and after the event is, you know, what really makes a difference. So a lot of people, most people go to conferences for, you know, to meet other people, not really for the presentations. And you completely miss out on that when you're just watching presentations on YouTube. They can be awesome, they can be great, but you completely miss out on everything around that. And it also allows us to very easily bring people into the conversation. So sometimes we do on those presentations or panels, we do this open it to some sort of a discussion where you can not only have people speak from the audience, you can even bring them on stage and have them be physically part of the presentation, which just makes it so much more like real life. It just feels a lot more like real life, but you have to be there. You know, that's the thing. The thing about those meetups, it's so hard to explain. And even if you watch the video, it doesn't really convey the feeling that you get when you're actually there. So it's really hard to explain it. I mean, one of the interesting thing, I used to tell this a lot. It's one of those times, my mother is my biggest fan, right? So she watched one of the streams of the VR meetups, and she couldn't tell which one of the people on stage is me, because we all look the same in the 3D space. So she told me that at some point I was scratching my head, and she could see that I'm scratching my head. And she said, "Oh, I know it's you, because it's the way that you scratch your head. I recognize it." So it really conveys a lot of those things that you usually could see in video, but it conveys them very well in avatar form. It's kind of hard to explain it, but it's, you know, it's there. So it's really cool in that way.
Yeah. May I add one or two things there? Because I think the privacy aspect that Udi mentioned, that's really underrated, because I think there are some people, especially in the Bitcoin space, that just can't go to conferences because of privacy reasons, or it's just a big hassle. And I think the fact that you can stay anonymous or pseudonymous and still attend conferences and meetups is just great. And another thing that I noticed is that in real life meet space conferences, a lot of people they have certain inhibitions, like you won't necessarily walk up to Adam Beck and introduce yourself and so on. And in VR, this is completely gone, it seems. Like people, Waxwing is speaking to VR, Adam Gibson, and people walked up to him all the time and just ask him random things. And it's so great to see. And it's also not... as annoying, I would say, because you can selectively mute people, you can also kick people, and you like nobody can hurt you in VR. You know, you can just hop away, and it's not as intimidating as in the physical space. And in terms of the presentations, I think there are a bunch of benefits there as well if you use them correctly. I mean, of course, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, and all those things can be abused as well. But you can just mute everyone, and Udi at the beginning of the presentations just always presses this God button. Everyone is on mute, and you know, the whole room is quiet instantly, and you cannot have that in meet space. And there are little things like that that's really funny. And I think as these systems develop and as the software gets better, I think we will see more and more things that you can only do in cyberspace. And I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I can just imagine teachers being really excited to get their hands on that mute button in their classroom. <Yeah. laughs> You know, I did a presentation on a show called Crypto Mondays. It's a VR presentation. Lou Kerner hosts it. And it was a crazy experience. It was my second VR experience after I did a Reckless VR a session. And the experience the first time was amazing. I was really blown away. And I walked around the room for 20 minutes before the presentation started, talking to people. And during the presentation, I was just exploring the space, basically. I wasn't really watching the presentation. I could still listen, but I was walking around everywhere, exploring things. And then on the Crypto VR presentation, I was up on the stage. There were probably about 30 or 40 virtual avatars out there. And I remember, like, similar to your scratching the head thing, Udi, I was like rocking back and forth in my office chair like this. And like Lou Kerner's like, are you sitting in a chair rocking back and forth? Apparently my avatar was going, back and forth like this. And it's just one of those things that as a VR noob, you don't think about or not used to yet. It's fascinating. So how do you think, the limitations of, let's talk about the limitations of VR, right? Because it's not obviously a panacea. VR has limitations. Obviously, MeetSpace does as well. We talked about some of the benefits or advantages of using VR over MeetSpace. But what are some of the disadvantages or limitations of VR, do you think, Udi?
Yeah, so, I said that setup is much easier than it used to be. But it's still, if you compare it to something like Zoom that you literally click a button and you're in the call, it's much more complex than that. It's actually ridiculous. The steps that someone has to go through to join one of the meetups, it's ridiculous. I have like a super long document and videos to explain how to do it for the first time. And it's just too much. And there's plenty of reasons for that. I think mostly it's just bad design, but there's definitely a lot of improvement to do there. What you would really want is to, kind of grab your phone and click the whatever event you want, and then put the VR headset on, and you're there. You don't have to do anything else. So that's what you would want to have, and we're still not there. But it's perfectly doable. I just think that the platforms and the apps that exist in VR today are just not at that level of readiness yet. So one of the things that I'm really missing that I think could do a huge difference is to have those things available on mobile devices too. So if you don't have VR headsets, which is most people, you can at least use your iPhone and or Android device and go into the meetup and walk around with, little controls on the screen. And obviously it's not the perfect experience, but at least you'll be able to get an idea of what it looks like and feels like. So then maybe you go out and buy a VR headset. I think that would be a huge benefit. And I know that a lot of them are working on it, but it's just not there yet.
Yeah. It seems like the resolution and all of those issues, the sensory experience is obviously very different in MeetSpace than it is in VR. But I kind of think where we are now is sort of like the Atari, compared to like the PS5 that's coming out, those kind of gaming experiences or a badass gaming machine running the latest, badass game, right? And the difference between the two is absolutely incredible in terms of the experience, the immersiveness, how real it looks. So, I presume that you think we'll probably get there at some point, basically recreate all the senses in virtual reality.
Yeah, probably, although it would probably take a very long time. I forget the guy's name. I think he's the chief scientist at Oculus, and he's a very, very known figure in the computer science and gaming world, who's every year is making this presentation where he talks about what VR is going to look like maybe decades from now. And he talks about things like, okay, what about smell in VR? What about feeling, you know, with your hands? What about, I don't know, whatever. And you know, maybe you can feel cold. Maybe you can feel heat. And he has a lot of ideas, and they're doing a ton of research on that. But it's obviously very far away. You know, it's not, we're talking decades ahead. But actually, things like, so if you look at the Oculus Quest, it has relatively low resolution, and it's powered by a mobile chip, like pretty much the same that you have on a phone, even not a new phone. So it's you know, technologically, it's not very advanced. But the experience can be so good that you kind of don't notice this stuff. Once you're really in it, it kind of goes away. The major advantage of the Oculus Quest over other, like, more technically capable headsets is that it doesn't require a cable that connects to your PC. So you're really free to move around. You can move your hands without getting stuck in your cable or whatever. So it's in that sense, it's just a better experience. So even though the visuals are not as good,
yeah,
the experience is so much better. And we can walk around, you know, the problems, like, it's very hard to read text in VR, especially in the Oculus Quest, because the resolution isn't great. So you make text a lot bigger in presentations. You try to fit less words into each slide. And you kind of, you know, try to design the content and experience to walk around, to kind of make the best of the hardware that you have. And then it can be a really great experience, even now.
I'm super excited about VR as well. I hope everybody listening, you know, checks it out, or at least reads up on it and finds a way to check it out. You can check out, you know, on your phone at the very least, put it into like a cardboard device and just have that first experience if you haven't yet. It is definitely going to be a part of our future. It's here and not going away. All right, let's get back into Bitcoin. Let's move to talking about full nodes. This is a topic that Udi requested to for us to discuss today. And I wonder if we can just start at the beginning. Gigi, if somebody asks you, the relatively new Bitcoiner, they come to you, they're like, okay, I've been hearing about this thing called full nodes. Why do I need to run one? What's your answer?
Well, yeah, probably it's going to be an explanation on how you want to actually validate the rules that Bitcoin is running on yourself. And if you want to really dig deep into this, then you also want to use your full node and validate your transactions with it yourself and so on. I think it's a very good learning device. Like, if you really want to learn about Bitcoin, setting up a full node and trying to use it and trying to understand what it does, I think it's an excellent teaching device. I think we're getting there in terms of like very easy to set up and install and quote unquote plug and play full nodes where you just set something up and at the end you scan a QR code with your phone and your phone is paired with your full node and everything just kind of works. I think in like a couple of years we are there. I'm actually quite impressed how fast everything is moving, especially on the open source side. But I think we're not there yet. So I think it's still mainly for hobbyists and enthusiasts and people that want to tinker with stuff like Lightning and people that are really hardcore and want to just validate everything themselves and want to be like first-class citizens, no compromises.
Rudy, what's your brief answer? You don't want to, you know, put this person to sleep or make them afraid to try to run a full node. What's your answer in a couple of minutes? Or less.
Yeah, it's really hard. I mean, I like Gigi's example about it being a good learning device. That's really true. But probably a lot of people don't want to learn too much. They just want to maybe invest in Bitcoin, forget about it. So it's difficult to answer. I mean, why would you want it? I think that a lot of times we say things like, oh, it's to keep the network safe and it's to, I don't know, it's to support the network. I don't think people care about that. At best, they care about their own Bitcoins. So what we should probably talk about is how you can be more sure about the validity of your own coins and the legitimacy of your own coins that you receive using your node if you use it. Although that's probably something that most people aren't concerned about or don't understand that they should be concerned about it. So maybe the biggest, easiest to explain advantage you get by using a full node is it's more private. You don't need to send the addresses that you're interested in, the addresses of your wallet. You don't have to send them to some third party to tell you what your balance is. You can just use your own node for that. So you leak less data, and I think that's maybe something that people will have an easier time to understand. So you can say, okay, you want to start using Bitcoin, maybe use a Bitcoin node because then you leak the least data that you would leak in any other way. And maybe in 10 years, you'll regret that you leaked some data. So maybe it's worth the time. It's worth investing an hour in setting it up and figuring it out what it does and how it works. That's probably the best incentive for most people to use one.
Awesome. So right now there are about 48,000 nodes, according to Luke Dasher's estimate. At the peak was, you know, in January 2018, about 200,000. Obviously, there's a clear connection between price and, you know, running a full node. Right now, we're at about 10,000 publicly accessible nodes. So besides price, how can we increase the number of full nodes? How can we make them more accessible, easier to use, and actually get, you know, tried and true Bitcoiners? Let's leave the new coiners aside, but Bitcoiners who've been around for a while and aren't using full nodes yet to get on board. Gigi, you want to start with this one?
Yeah, sure. I think as with all those kind of, I want to say technical Bitcoin things, I feel like Bitcoin has a way of sorting this out naturally and organically. I think that, for example, if we wouldn't have had Mt. Gox, then we probably wouldn't have Not Your Keys, Not Your Coins, you know? And I can't answer you what the event will be that people set up their own full node and will be forced to run their own full node. But there might be an event or multiple events where people realize it's really smart to run your own full node. And the beauty about Bitcoin is that there is no barrier to entry and everyone just can start running it. And so if we see any sort of concentrations, censorship, funny business with fees, whatever have you, like there are some scenarios you can imagine where suddenly it gets really beneficial to run full nodes. And I think then people will start to care, as we've seen with private keys as well. You know, people only start to care when shit really hits the fan. And there are some paranoid people like us that are ahead of the curve and are early to these kind of things. But the masses will come in when they have to. And I feel like Bitcoin has a way of forcing the hand of the masses at some point in time.
Absolutely agree with that. That's a great answer. Udi, do you have anything to weigh in on this here?
That's the perfect answer. I feel like Gigi is reading my mind. It's exactly this. We wouldn't have other wallets if people didn't lose that much money in Mt. Gox. And maybe sometime, you know, someone does a better job at trying something like Segwit2x, for example, and they actually manage to do a more successful attack than the Segwit2x was, which completely failed. So maybe then people realize, okay, we should run full nodes to protect ourselves from those kind of things.
I have a great question here from, thanks for the conversation about full nodes, guys. I really appreciate that. Your answers were on point and I think really useful to Bitcoiners and new coiners alike. So appreciate the thoughts there. We have a great question from the YouTube chat. Do either of the guests believe that due to Bitcoin, the next superpower, global superpower, will not be a country and will instead be the internet, as it is the first time when we have a native currency on the internet itself? Do you think that Bitcoin will be the driver for that?
I think it's obvious that the next superpower will be American HODL or some other way, you know, just the first trillionaire of the planet. Yeah, I don't know. It's a really interesting question. I recently reread The Sovereign Individual, and it lays out a very nice path towards what might happen and how the nation states dissolve. It's really hard to see for me how this might play out. And I think most people agree that it will get really ugly. And I tend to agree as well. I think you know, Bitcoin is still so small. It's basically a rounding error on the balance sheets of the big nations. So Bitcoin really doesn't matter yet. And I think once it really starts to matter, it can get relatively ugly relatively quickly. And I don't know what will happen in wartime, so to speak. So if something arises that might be seen as powerful as a nation state, I can't tell you what happens, because nation states are still extremely powerful. The beautiful thing about Bitcoin is, Julian Assange liked to say, no amount of violence will ever solve a math problem. So you're kind of immune in cyberspace in a way from all the tanks and all the fighter jets of the world. Only to an extent, though, because I'd like to remind everyone that, you know, the internet is just a series of tubes, and once, you know, the infrastructure is actually attacked, then shit can also get really ugly really quickly. But the good thing is that the infrastructure is set up in a way that it can root around it, and it's like all these decentralized unkillable networks are really built to withstand this. So I tend to be optimistic. But I to answer the question more briefly than I already did, I think I agree with the thesis laid out in The Sovereign Individual. I just don't really know how it will shape up, like how it will really take shape. And it's really hard to tell, because I feel like every 2 or 3 months the real world environment gets more and more chaotic and the political landscape gets more and more chaotic, and it's really hard to make sense of things. So it's extremely hard to predict such things. I think it can happen, but I have no idea how.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the defining factor of a nation state kind of becoming sovereign is being able to issue its own money. That's how the root of control comes from. So now that the internet has basically issued its own money, the decentralized form of it, Udi, do you think that the internet becomes the new form of a nation state? Or just obsoletes them all in together in any way?
Yeah, I wouldn't write off nation states just yet. I think it's probably too early. I think that, yeah, they're definitely still very powerful. Bitcoin is definitely still very weak. And just to add to what Gigi said, I would say if you talk to some protocol developers working on Bitcoin, I think they would be much less optimistic than most of us on the unstoppable nature of the Bitcoin network. Because there are many ways in which nation states can probably disturb the network. I wouldn't say kill Bitcoin, because I just wouldn't say that, but I think killing Bitcoin is a very big task. But you can definitely make things very difficult. You can definitely make it much smaller and much less threatening, and something that only the most extreme, you know, devoted people use, and most people just won't choose to use it. And that's, you know, that's how nation states fix problems usually. They just make it much less accessible for most of them. So I think that's still definitely something that can be done. You can see that developers are making huge progress all the time, even these days, to make the network more resilient, even in things like, you know, P2P connection between nodes and things that are, you know, that we usually don't talk about. People love to talk about 51% attacks, but there are tons of other things you can do to temporarily affect the Bitcoin network. So yeah, I don't think we're a good opponent yet to nation states.
If I may add something there, I've two thoughts popped into my head while Udi was answering. I think I very much agree that most core developers are very, very cautious about Bitcoin's guarantees, and they know best what can break. But I see this over and over in tech, and just also in science in general. I think people that are really close to the matter, they tend to be very pessimistic. And if you look, for example, at chip designers, and like people tell you that Moore's Law is dead since 20 years. Every single chip designer that designed chips for the last 20 years was like, we hit the limit and we can't go smaller anymore. And now we have quantum tunneling and Moore's Law is dead and we can't improve anymore. But if you analyze it from a bird's eye view, a different picture emerges. And we saw this also with genome sequencing, and we see this all over the place. Like the people that are really close to it, they know what goes wrong all the time, and they also know what can go wrong. And they sometimes are, in my opinion, too pessimistic. That's why I'm, even though I'm kind of close to technology as well, I tend to counteract this phenomenon by just being extremely optimistic and super bullish all the time. countering my own bias. And the second thing I'd like to point out is I also agree with Udi that we shouldn't underestimate nation states and governments. And I think governments are really good at undermining and subverting things. They have a really, like, they're very good at playing the long game. And if you just look at the internet and what happened to the internet, basically, you know, in many jurisdictions, net neutrality is dead. We have the great firewall of China. We have upload filters. We have stupid cookie banners that you have to click or install extensions to block. And we have all kinds of weird things that kind of break the internet in subtle ways. And this happened over the last, I don't know, 20 years or so. And it was a very long game, but it kind of worked. And of course, we also have the NSA like doing deep packet inspection and other things, like messing with stuff everywhere on every level. And I think we should be very, very cautious, because if we are not eternally vigilant in the Bitcoin space, these kind of things will happen as well, I think.
Absolutely. Well, if Bitcoin Investment Zen is DCA and dollar cost averaging recurring buys, then I think Bitcoin Speculation Zen is somehow trying to manage a balance between the utter bullishness and humility, right? That Matt Odell is always talking about. It's a hard balance to reach. Corey is going to weigh in on this one. Corey, we're chatting here about the ability of, or the potential for, Bitcoin as a native currency of the internet, a distributed non-sovereign currency, to compete against nation states, of course, who draw their power from, in large part, from being able to issue their own sovereign currency.
Yeah, it is a super interesting issue, and certainly one that I'm vocal about and think about a lot. And I think the range of outcomes are wide and dispersed. And so when you're looking to try to affect that, as I personally am, and as we're trying to do with Swan here in the US, and you know, kind of our stated goal and mission for the company is to get as many Bitcoiners as possible, you know, ramped up and owning a meaningful chunk, and also being educated enough to be, you know, willing to write a letter to a congressman or show up at a town hall meeting or fight for Bitcoin in some way. And so, you know, that's the whole thesis behind 10 million Bitcoiners in the US, which is, you know, that 3-4% intransigent minority that can sort of flip a complex system like a country, or at least prevent the country from going the other direction. And we see this, you know, this is basically the logic behind lobbying in general and regulatory capture. So let's do it for Bitcoin, right? And make sure that the really noisy vocal people that really care about Bitcoin can stop anything really bad from happening. So I think it's a race to get enough Bitcoiners with enough power and who care enough versus people in government, deep state, whatever, recognizing the threat that Bitcoin poses and coalescing enough support at all sorts of different levels. I don't actually think that the government or the powers that be actually have a good shot, but I just think anything that you can do to reduce that chance is fantastic, because it just means that Bitcoin will have a clearer path, more of a chance of reaching its destination or its destiny sooner and wider without that interference. And then just, you know, selfishly for myself and my family and my friends and people that won't necessarily want to uproot and have to go somewhere else to spend our Bitcoin or just to run a Bitcoin company or whatever, you know, I'd rather do that here in sunny Southern California without government interference. So I'm just trying to make sure that we get there fast.
If I may add something to that, I think I agree with you as well, Corey, that You know, Bitcoin also has a way to protect itself against, too much meddling. Because if you are the government employee tasked with interfering with Bitcoin and exploring it, you might just end up stacking yourself because Bitcoin is, it doesn't really care, and it's money for enemies. And I think we saw that a lot with the discussions in Congress. Was it last year or maybe even 2 years ago? I lost track of time the last couple of years. But it's latently obvious that there are some Bitcoiners in Congress and some people that really get it and some people that obviously have Bitcoin. And they're way too knowledgeable to not have Bitcoin. And I think we might see this work out well in the long run, that just people, you know, if they have a choice to get themselves onboarded, so to speak, they might, end up working for Bitcoin and not for the government anymore. That's what I'm trying to say.
So we already have a lot of great examples of this. For instance, Catherine Hahn, who was federal prosecutor that was supposed to go and prosecute Bitcoin. And she learned a lot about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency and now runs the crypto fund for Andreessen Horowitz.
There you go.
And you've got the FBI agents that were, hunting down Ross. And of course, they ended up being crooked and trying to stack as much Bitcoin as possible. So I think you'll see it kind of over and over again. And, you know, we've got Warren Davidson out there tweeting again this week about how awesome Bitcoin is. That's a US representative, and it's just super cool to see that. And these people that are anti-Bitcoin can't keep their posts forever. We also got the news this morning that, New York Department of Financial Services, NYDFS, this is the one that Lasky used to be at, and he saddled the New York State with the Bit license. So they've since moved the Bit license under a new department, an innovation department inside DFS, and given it a new head, and that person is much more open, and they're bringing back the conditional Bit license, which makes it much easier for companies like Swan. It's much cheaper and much faster to be able to operate in New York. So we're going to be chasing that really fast now that that news is out this morning. So I think the logic of Bitcoin is just unassailable. And if you are both smart and honest, you'll always end up being a fan of Bitcoin. If you're smart and dishonest, then you'll be like Roy Seabag and Peter Schiff and just kind of use Bitcoin to try to market your gold company. And if you're dumb and honest, then you often end up, doing DeFi projects or something.
Ouch.
Yeah, we're on a call here with Udi Wertheimer, and Corey gets the first shitcoin dig in. You're off your game, Udi. No, I appreciate it.
I do want to note, by the way, that somebody tweeted this morning that because everybody's going nuts for these DeFi popcorn alts that are going up like 5x and stuff. If you weren't in way long ago, you're just about to get wrecked. One of the largest hodlers, it looks like it was either Coinbase Ventures or another venture fund, were sitting there on Coinbase ready to dump, like literally the second that it went live. And a few minutes later, it was down like 47%. And Compound is the most recent one. There's been more comp tokens moved to Coinbase to be sold than all comp tokens that have ever been farmed in the history of the project. Whatever the hell that means. I don't know. It's yield farming. Anyway, it's basically BitConnect.
Hey, hey, hey.
It is basically BitConnect, yeah.
If you have inside information and the SEC doesn't know that you have inside information, then by all means, play the game and stack more sats by pumping and dumping. Just make sure you're on the pump side and that you dump just in time. But if you don't know what you're doing, just stay the hell away from it. If you're not insider trading these tokens, don't bother. You'll get wrecked.
Yeah, if you don't know who you're going to dump on, then there's no reason to buy it, basically.
Then you're about to get dumped on.
Then you're about to.
Yeah.
You can't spot the sucker at the table. You are the sucker.
Yeah.
All right. Well, yeah, I mean, it's a little depressing. Those of us who went through the 2017, early 18 bubble, and witnessed all of that utter scammery. It's a little depressing to kind of see the writing on the wall for this next run. That it's, you know, it's not going to be over, obviously. So, all right. As we mentioned at the top of the show, you know, that we Bitcoiners really like our analogies. I think we probably like our memes even more. I think we probably have Bitcoin down to just two memes now. One, money printer go burr, and then two, Bitcoin fixes this. So I think that tells the whole story right there. Two questions. First one is, how will fixing the money change, or how could it change our culture and society? We already talked about the nation state stuff, the governance stuff, but culture, society, individuals. Gigi, you want to start with this one?
Yeah, sure. That's such a great question. And I love this stuff. We had a long conversation about it with John Wallis at the Value of Bitcoin conference. And it was about basically how the individual changes once Bitcoin is adopted. And I think you can see this over and over again. If you just look at different kinds of Bitcoiners, how their life changes or how their life changed once they discovered Bitcoin. And, you know, you have people that stopped smoking and started eating healthy and used the money they saved by not smoking anymore to stack sets. And it is just obvious that it changes you in some way. And it's kind of weird. And I don't really understand it, even though it happened to me as well. And I think the best explanation I've heard so far, but I think it goes even deeper, but I think the best explanation so far is from Saifedean as well, that it just lowers your time preference massively. That once you realize that you can actually lay out a plan for yourself and your family and the next generations for, you know, the next decades, like not the next weeks or months, but the next decades. And you also realize, you know, I don't actually need like this new car now, or this new bike, or this new gadget, or whatever. And I can save some money here and there and stack some sets. And maybe I can build a better future just with that. It will change your whole life and lifestyle drastically. And we saw this over and over again. Obviously, it doesn't happen to everyone and not at the same rate. But I think there is a trend that we can see. And a lot of people, you know, there's this meme also, stop going to a hairdresser, just shave your own hair and cut your own hair, stack sets instead. And I think that encapsulates it very nicely. You just try to think long-term, save a little bit of money on the side, stack sets with those, and just, try to also be a better person and work towards a better future for yourself and also for your family and thus for your community and for society. And I think that's how it spreads from the individual.
I think it's a very fun meme, very, as Gigi says, it's, you know, there's also a lot to learn from it, but also I hope that we're kind of realizing the effect that it has on the side who's hearing it, and that we use it, intelligently. So, usually when you're going to tell someone that Bitcoin fixes this, their response is going to be to hang up the call because it's just not, you know, it's not very helpful. Now, sometimes that's what you want. So, like maybe you're in conversation with a no-coiner who just doesn't get it. He's debating for the sake of the debate and you want to shut them down. So you tell them Bitcoin fixes this and you go make dinner. So that's perfectly fine. But if you're trying to convince the person to change their mind, I think it's usually very unlikely that saying Bitcoin fixes this will change anyone's mind. So I just hope that people are aware of this. It's important with these memes to think of, you know, to use them, I don't want to say responsibly, but to use them correctly, you know, use them to your own advantage. Don't use them, you know, without thinking of what it looks like to the other side. It's definitely what you want sometimes, but not always.
Would you say that you are using memes responsibly on Twitter?
Oh, I mean, so the question is what I want to do with it, right? So I think I use it responsibly for my own goals. I'm not sure if it's good for anyone else, though.
Fair enough. Yeah, I think those memes are, the way I see it is the memes really help to distill the conversation and distill narratives in a way. And I think it's a way to rally around the memes. You know, it's a way for Bitcoiners especially to rally around the memes. I really hope that people don't use it as a one sentence answer if someone comes to them and it's like, you know, what is Bitcoin? And they will just answer with those two memes and run away. I really hope they don't do that. If they do, then, well, we will have a hard time onboarding people. But I think Matt has the right idea in those regards that, you know, you kind of have to stay humble and also chill lightly. And I think people will come to you once they are ready. And I truly believe, I think that this was one of the biggest insights I had in the last couple of years, is that people will get Bitcoin once they are truly ready. And they will also get their first Bitcoins once they are truly ready. I think there is no other way. I think there is no way to force people into Bitcoin. It's an opt-in voluntary system. And if you force people into Bitcoin, I think you will do more harm than good most of the time. They will sell once they have the first doubts or panic, and they will sell at exactly the wrong time, or they will lose their keys, or they will get into shit coins because they just don't understand anything. And I think it's really true that Bitcoin will kind of find you once you're ready for it. And that's also usually the time or around the time where you kind of purchase and hold your first Bitcoin.
All right, so the corollary to this question is, of course, Bitcoin can't fix everything. So what are some of the things that Bitcoin doesn't fix or change if it becomes widely adopted? Udi?
Udi goes first, please.
Yeah, Udi goes first this time.
What doesn't Bitcoin fix? Wow. that could be a long talk.
Yeah, yes.
I think that the process of someone starting to get into Bitcoin is very slow, which I think is probably what we really like about it. It's a process. It's a continuous process. You keep learning for years and maybe decades, and that's really great. But it's also very slow to affect people. So when you see someone who has a very real problem, I can't get my money out of my country. Maybe my government is not allowing me to leave the country. Maybe I'm being, I don't know, oppressed in some ways. You have someone who really has a very real problem, and you're gonna tell them, okay, so you should be stacking sats. I think that's not the best thing to say to a person. Of course, sometimes Bitcoin might actually solve your problem. Maybe you're trying to move money abroad, and Bitcoin will help you there. But more often than not, when people are having like real, pressing issues, Bitcoin might not be their solution, the immediate solution. Maybe they can go get on the Bitcoin track and change their lives in some way because they learn new things about themselves and about how the world works through Bitcoin. That happens to a lot of people, but that's a long process. So, you know, if I have a problem today, probably the solution is not, okay, you should learn about yourself and learn about the world and fix your problem. That's probably not what you're going to look for. So, and you see that a lot. You see a lot of people sometimes saying, yeah, Bitcoin, you should have just bought Bitcoin, or you should just buy Bitcoin right now and that will fix your problem. It's obviously a joke at best. So, yeah.
Well, what doesn't Bitcoin fix?
Nothing.
I'm tempted to channel my inner Piero Shard and just say Bitcoin fixes literally absolutely everything. But, you know, I think the one thing that Bitcoin really doesn't fix is stupidity in a way. And interestingly, I think what it fixes is greed. And I think I think Alex Gladstein talked about that very eloquently a while ago, that it is a machine that turns greed into freedom. And I think there is something profoundly true about that, that it utilizes a really bad thing about humanity, that humans are generally selfish and greedy, and it uses it for its own advantage. And I think that's quite beautiful. But I think, yeah, a lot of stupidity will still continue to be had in the Bitcoin space. And I think we haven't even seen the worst of it yet. I'm afraid with the next cycle, and especially if we have something like a super cycle that some people talk about, where we hit escape velocity and just everything goes insanely crazy, and all the fiat currencies hyperinflate and stuff like that, I think we will see government level shitcoins and Ponzi schemes and government level exit scams that, like 2017, will will be like child's play. And so I think it can't fix stupid, but it really can fix a lot of other things. And I think also the beautiful thing about Bitcoin is it has a way to keep people honest in a way. And I really like that. And I think it's because Bitcoin is also like this bastion of truth and this like grand truth anchor that everyone agrees upon. And again, to loop back to what I said in the very beginning, the biology analogy, I like it so much because I think the only way to thrive in the Bitcoin space is to find a way to live in symbiosis with it, like to find a way to not fight against it. Once you fight against Bitcoin, you've already lost. You might not realize it yet, but you will end up with all the other lunatics that try to change the block size, for example, and or you know, pick your favorite lunatic camp.
All right, I have an interesting one. This came up in the Telegram chat room. I think it was Phil Gibbs that brought it up. And this is something that I've heard personally in real life as well, some pushback against my, Bitcoin shilling and belief that it will, you know, help fix a lot of things. It is this idea that we Bitcoiners, early Bitcoiners, are sort of benefiting in a Cantillon effect type way from being close to the early, you know, distribution schedule, so that when everyone else comes flooding in, we'll essentially become the Cantillionaires of Bitcoin because we were closer to the beginning of the distribution schedule. It seems to have some intuitive reasoning to it. I hear it resonating with my friends and people who are pushing back against Bitcoin. I would love to hear how you guys would refute that if a new coiner or a no coiner brought that up to you.
Well, I would say everyone who says that obviously hasn't held any Bitcoin ever, because it's really hard. It drives you insane. Once you rode the waves for a couple of months or a couple of years, you realize that this is not, you know, like free money that you just get by being early. And I think you see this over and over and over again. Pick your favorite time interval. It was so in like 2013. It was so even earlier. You know, like people saw it drop from I don't know, almost $20 back to $1 and stuff like that. And it got even easier now over time in percentage terms. So holding Bitcoin and getting into Bitcoin is not for the faint of heart, and it's nothing, you know, that comes easy, I think. And it's really hard to live off ramen noodles because you don't have any fiat in your bank account left for an extended period of time, even though you might have some sats, but you really don't want to sell. And I think if you never experienced that, it's really easy to say, oh yeah, you just got early and you got lucky. And I just can't wait for the first person to really tell this to my face, that I just got really, really lucky. And
Yeah, I'll chime in there, because it's such a false comparison. It's apples and oranges, because what you're talking about is the flow, not the stock. What you're talking about is who is benefiting from the new issuance, and where does that new issuance go, and how does that new issuance come about? And, you know, whatever you want to say, the issuance was known, it was available, it was on the internet from day one. I did not have the foresight or intelligence or interests at the time to get in as early as I wish that I had, but I cannot begrudge the people that did have that kind of foresight, that kind of understanding, spent a lot of time on Slashdot in 2011 or whatever it was, the fortunate set of circumstances that's a mix of, you know, some luck and some preparation that results in you having a fat stack and then having the fortitude, as Gigi was saying, to actually hodl it for that long. I don't begrudge anybody that has giant stacks from long before I got involved in Bitcoin, and I don't really know people that do. If they do feel that way, they just don't really understand Bitcoin. And then if you're looking at it, you know, in present day, there are bankers right now spending tons and tons of money on lobbyists and tons of money on, you know, entertaining government officials so that they can get, you know, zero or negative interest rate loans and then turn around and, you know, lend it back out to retail, to normal people. And small businesses and take that arbitrage and lever it up, you know, 30, 40X. So that becomes like a big return. So the whole game is completely fixed. That's what a Cantillionaire is. you are in perfect competition as a Bitcoin miner or somebody trying to buy Bitcoin at a market price on an exchange or from an OTC desk or from a service like Swan today. You don't have any advantage over any other human because of your closeness to people in DC or New York. And so it's just a patently false comparison.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have nothing to add on the Cantillion and Cantillionaire side of things, but I also want to add that just look at some Bitcoiners. For example, Andreas Antonopoulos was completely broke because he lived on Bitcoin. And so what I'm trying to say as well is that people don't realize that it's really hard to hold onto your Bitcoin as well. And I like the saying, I think it was actually John Carvalho who said it once, that Bitcoins want to be free. You know, like it's really easy to spend your Bitcoins. It doesn't matter if it's on socks or on pizza or on whatever. That's why we have also Pizza Day. And I think we will see this all over again. You know, now people are experimenting with Lightning and just sending like millions of Satoshi tips left and right and just buying stickers online all the time. And I'm pretty sure if we, and I'm guilty as well, you know, but if we look back in like 10 years or 20 years, it's like, you know, I bought a couple stickers for, I don't know, 50 million Satoshis and my grandkids would probably kill me. But, you know, that's just all part of the game. And people that are not into Bitcoin, they have no idea what it entails. You actually want to play around with it. You want to spend it. You want to see what it can do. You want to do some transactions. And it's not a lottery ticket. It's way harder than that.
Yeah, it's I agree with both Corey and Gigi. Corey said that he doesn't know anyone who begrudge like early adopters. I certainly know a few. I mean, people tend to say that. I would say there are two categories of people who would say something like that. One is someone who just doesn't get it. Not doesn't get Bitcoin, just doesn't get anything. And the other kind is someone who's just basically lying because they have other interests and they trying to probably promote their own shitcoin with their own very fair scheme. But those are the two types of people who would say it. I mean, you know, look at anything in life. I mean, are you not, if you think that the Apple stock is going to go up, are you going to not buy Apple stock because some people got in earlier than you and some people were able to, you know, acquire Apple stock at the very earliest of days? That's silly. I mean, why would you do that to yourself? If you think that Bitcoin has something in it, then you should probably look into it, consider to invest regardless of how many Bitcoins other people have. And that's true for everything in life. And it's just a very bad mentality to have, I think. It's just, you know, so I think you tend to hear it from people who just never invested actively in anything. So they kind of, for the first time, think through those very basic concepts that are true for every type of asset. So yeah, Bitcoin grew and people who were there first, they made some money off of it. There's nothing you can do about it, and that's life. And also, I think that considering, you know, how the inflation schedule works, it's probably pretty much as fair as it could be. I don't see how it could be better. You know, I don't see how anything that comes later can possibly be more fair than what Bitcoin is. Like, if you try to replicate it again, I think it's necessarily going to be much less fair. So, for some arbitrary definition of fair, right? I don't know what fair even means, but it's probably going to be not as good as Bitcoin's distribution is. So it's the best we've got. And if people want to complain about it, they can, but there's really not much to do about it.
Yeah, I obviously agree with that. And I think Dan Held wrote a nice piece about that Bitcoin's distribution was fair. And it also speaks to the fact that, you know, it was the first and nobody knew about anything like Bitcoin. And now there are so many eyes on the space. If something else would, you know, advertise itself as having a fair launch, all the people would front run it and try to get their hands on it as early as possible. And I'd also like to point out that looking at Bitcoin as an investment, I think, is the wrong way to look at it in a way. And I think a lot of Bitcoiners that hear that immediately understand what I'm trying to get at. And a lot of no-coiners really don't get that at all. And it takes a long time to get that because I don't have an exit plan when it comes to Bitcoin. I don't want to convert back into Euro or USD or something, you know? So fiat is dead to me already. And I think there are like many phases in the life of a Bitcoiner, or many phases in understanding Bitcoin. And I think one of the most important steps is just realizing that this is the end game and you don't want to go back. And once you don't, once you are at this point, you start understanding Bitcoin as a savings technology. And before that point, you understand it only as an investment. And I think people that view it as an investment, view it as something where you can just magically throw money at, wait 10 years, and then you're a millionaire in dollar terms, and then you do whatever with your $1 million. But I think most Bitcoiners are not about that. And I think that's why it's also so hard to communicate to no-coiners what this is really about.
I, of course, agree with all you guys. And that was a fantastic smackdown of that FUD. But I do, you know, if I were a betting man, I would never bet Bitcoin. But if I were to, I would put some money down on this being used in the future against Bitcoiners, because it's one of those kind of surface FUD, you know, kind of like the energy thing that seems, you know, probable or seems realistic or reasonable on the surface. You don't have to dig too much to understand it. And, you know, it obviously makes us look like, you know, money grubbing Ponzi schemers or something. So I definitely think that we're going to see this one in the future as Bitcoin becomes more and more successful. Okay, let's close up with this one. This is a question from our creative director at Swan, Brecky von Bitcoin. He asks, so let's assume that Satoshi is watching right now and, you know, popped into the conversation, right? We invited him in, he popped into the conversation. What would you say to them, or what would you ask them? One or the other, because I think both might be difficult. It's kind of an on-the-spot question. So what might you say or ask to Satoshi? Who wants it?
My question would be, whatever happened to the poker client in the very early Bitcoin code base? I would be really interested in that.
Wait, there was a poker client in the early coin?
Yeah, there was poker client in it. It never really launched. It was, I think it was part of the code that was shared around on internal mails pretty much to some select people. Yeah, that would be a fun conversation, I think. what the thinking was in like showing a first use case or something.
That's a great one.
More seriously, I would be really interested in, you know, like in the universe, there are some natural constants, some laws of nature that nobody really knows where the numbers come from. And we have this in Bitcoin as well. And I would really like Satoshi's answers to how he came up with the constants that are in Bitcoin, like the 21 million hard cap and the 10 minute block time and stuff like that. There are some constants in Bitcoin where you could have chosen any number, pretty much numbers that are close to it. I mean, obviously with block propagation and block time, there's some thought behind it, but it's just such a nice round, like, yeah, roughly 10 minutes should work, enter. That's how I think he came up with it. But I would love to pick his brain, how he came up with all these numbers.
So the question was, what would I ask if Adam Back popped into the conversation right now?
Yes, that's the question.
No, he's not Satoshi. Every time I make the joke, I feel like I have to make that clear that he's not Satoshi. So I don't know. I was trying to think about it. All I could think of is this joke. I don't know. I mean, I might have asked him, like, just, you know, look at Bitcoin today. Is that anything like what you imagine, just for sentimental value? Or I don't think that the answer would have any meaning, but it's just interesting from, you know, the historical standpoint, like what were you thinking? Like things like the poker client, it makes you feel like maybe what he was going for is maybe it, you know, some system that you can use for gambling, which was very difficult at the time online for legal reasons. So maybe that was something he thought about, but maybe not. I think it would just, you know, look at something like Lightning. Is that something that you were thinking of? And I mean, for some of those things, we know the answers because we know, you know, from the early writings on Bitcoin Talk, we know that Satoshi thought of ideas similar to payment channels and so on. But, you know, like, is that what you had in mind? Or did we like completely go ahead and do something else, which is very likely the case? But yeah, just the curiosity, really.
All right, thanks, guys. Corey, do you have any other questions or topics to bring up to close us out? Or otherwise, we'll just kind of go to closing words and wrap this thing up.
Yeah, let's wrap. This was awesome.
All right, cool. Gigi, Udi, what do you guys got going on? What's coming up on Reckless Review? Anything, projects that you can talk about, Udi?
Yeah, so I would go to Reckless VR on Twitter or recklessvr.com to check out our next meetups. We have a meetup every Saturday. They're all great. It's not because of me, it's because we managed to get really good speakers to speak at those meetups. It's great content, whether you watch them like on YouTube or if you actually take the steps to join face-to-face, which is a great way to get Bitcoiners that some of them you've never met and wish you have met, and some of them, you know, you've met before, but maybe not going to meet for the next few months at least. So I really recommend it. If you didn't check it out yet, definitely check out Reckless VR.
Gigi, you have anything that you want to talk about? Any upcoming projects that you'd like to tease?
Yeah, well, I still have like one or two articles to write, I feel, and I'm playing around with some ideas. I really like what we talked in the beginning, how to best describe Bitcoin and all the analogies evolved over time, and I'm trying to collect my thoughts as coherently as I can currently, so expect something on that front as well. But no, other than that, just feel free to check out my stuff on Twitter. And you can also read my book for free online, 21 Lessons. You can also buy it on Amazon if you want to get rid of your dirty fiat. I will gladly take it and convert it to sats. So there's that. And yeah, I'll be sticking around. So don't worry about that.
Corey, any closing thoughts?
I'll just preview a couple things coming down the pipe real quick for Swan fans here in the US. So we should have one-time purchases for Swan plan members sometime in the next month or so. So a lot of people have been asking for the ability to top up or just go heavy outside of their recurring purchase plans. And so we're planning to enable that. We'll also be enabling wires at the same time so that you can fund and, you know, either later that day or the next day, be able to put your dirty fiat to work buying Bitcoin. So that'll be fun. And then we should also be launching the arsenal soon, which is essentially a collection of weapons to use in the money meme wars of the 2020s. So that's something that Brecky von Bitcoin is spearheading with a bunch of Bitcoin artists and meme warriors all over the world. And we'll have, you know, finished memes and quotes and building blocks for memes that people can just grab under Creative Commons and use however they want to promote Bitcoin and combat FUD and red pill no coiners and all those great things. So really excited to see that roll out. And also Swan merch is coming, and that is not a profit center for us. All of the merch will just be available on Zazzle or Cafe Press with awesome Swan designs and Bitcoin designs. And we do not take any splits or profits there. So just whatever it costs to print a shirt or a mug or a sweatshirt or whatever, you'll be able to do that. So that's kind of the next few weeks of fun things coming from Swan. And this was awesome, you guys. Really just a great conversation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah,
yeah, this was great.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Udi.
Yeah, it was great. Thanks for having me. I had a lot. It's always fun to speak with Gigi, and it was great meeting you, both of you. So thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having me as well. Always fun to, you know, talk Bitcoin and the implications and everything that surrounds this weird, beautiful thing.
Likewise, guys, I had a lot of fun. And I wanted to just let you guys know, if you're, you know, watching, you can also subscribe to the podcast, swansignalpodcast.com, and we'll publish the audio there. The archive is there. We've got 15 fantastic episodes. This is another one that will be on the feed very soon. Gigi reminded me of another service, actually. Of course, Swan is a great place to auto-stack your Bitcoin, but Gigi reminded me of another service there. Yeah, I also recommend WeBuyDirtyFiat.com. You can check that one out as well. It's an alternative to Swan. And you should check out our referral program. Get the details at swanbitcoin.com/enlist. That's it for this week. It's a wrap on this edition of Swan Signal Live. Thanks. Thanks to Gigi and Udi for joining us. You can follow Twitter. Thanks to Gigi and Udi for joining us. You can follow Gigi on Twitter at dergigi, at D-E-R-G-I-G-I. And you can follow Udi at Udi Wertheimer. That's at U-D-I-W-E-R-T-H-E-I-M-E-R. Corey is at Corey Klipsten, C-O-R-Y-K-L-I-P-P-S-T-E-N. And I am at Citizen Bitcoin. On behalf of the Swan team, thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed the episode of the Swan Signal podcast. Join us live next time. We'd love to have you. You can jump into our Swan Signal Telegram chat room. We have a lively crew in there that chat during our conversations and all throughout the weeks between. You can find that chat at t.me/SwanSignal. Swan Signal is a production of Swan Bitcoin at swanbitcoin.com, the best way to buy Bitcoin. One, you connect your bank account. We auto-withdraw USD from it. Then we automatically purchase Bitcoin for you. And finally, you can set up automatic withdrawals to your Bitcoin wallet. Otherwise, it will be held very securely by our licensed and regulated custodian. We do this all at the lowest fees for recurring purchases in the United States, up to 80% lower than Coinbase, absolutely crushing Coinbase's fees, and up to 57% lower than Cash App's fees for automatic recurring purchases. That's it for this week. Thanks for joining us.